Ward Churchill is a longtime member of the American Indian Movement and currently a professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. His writings address the genocidal nature of this country's onslaught against the native populations of the Americas. In his book, Pacifism as Pathology, he has addressed the hegemonic form of resistance among the left today, wherein pacifism entails symbolic as opposed to actual opposition to the state. Included among his many publications are Fantasies of the Master Race, Agents of Repression, the COINTELPRO Papers, Marxism and Native Americans. It is my honor to introduce to you Ward Churchill.
See you. Oh, see you. Oh, my relatives, good to see you here. I'd like to have another round of applause before we go any further at all, both for the collective, for having organized the event, for Jim Page, for having introduced it with a powerful song. Brother, you do well. And I'd like to introduce myself in a bit more traditional way. Not that anything that was said was inaccurate, and that's how I'm known. That's my colonial name. That's how I sign my writings. And so to that extent, it's appropriate. But traditionally, we introduce ourselves by way of people. Who are your people? And you take that through your mother. It's my people through my mother, the Kutua Band of Cherokee. But things get more complicated than that, because by virtue of marrying an Ojibwe woman, which meant that our children, had they been born, would have been considered Ojibwe rather than Cherokee, I take my identity now not just from my mother's clan, but from my wife's, which means Piju, Lynx clan, from Onigamin Kuchiching in the area of Turtle Island they now call Canada. So I bring you greetings from my mother's people, the Kutua Band of Cherokee, from the Piju, from the elders of the Colorado chapter of the American Indian Movement, of which I'm part, and from Gwarthy Las, otherwise known as Leonard Peltier, who tonight as I speak to you continues to sit in a cage at the federal prison, Leavenworth, Kansas, not for anything anyone, including even his prosecutor, has been prepared to say they believe he actually did. That's at any point in the last 15, 20 years in any event. But rather, he sits in that cage as a symbol of the arbitrary ability of the federal government of the United States to repress legitimate aspirations to liberation of indigenous people within its claimed boundaries. And the emphasis there is on claim. There's a difference between what the U.S. claims and that to which the United States is entitled. And we can talk a bit about how this entity, this thing, in which we're all encapsulated, this United States, as it calls itself, came to be, and the cost and consequence of that to the indigenous, the people of this land. We can talk about that tonight. We can talk about the cost and consequence of that process to those who came and conquered. And we can talk probably more importantly about the fact that in a certain sense, and I don't want to be misunderstood in this, because I say this doesn't mean that you're somebody's relative or you should go out and peddle a sweat lodge tomorrow because somehow you're genetically entitled to do so or whatever, but in a certain sense, everyone, the whole world at this point is becoming Indians. The calculus, the geometry of warfare. Everywhere on the planet at this point is beginning to approximate the inequities that were evident, the disparities of firepower that were evident, the disparities in almost everything of a military nature that were evident in the warfare between the incoming settler population, the invader population on the one hand, and the indigenous defenders on the other. You think about it. In 1991, in the Gulf War, there were 250,000 odd military casualties in Iraq on the part of the Iraqis. There were less than 200 on the side of the United States. And of those 200, very, very few died as a result of hostile fire. It's killing with impunity. It's slaughter. It's not warfare. It is genocide. And genocide is something with which the people of this land are familiar. It's not necessarily something that is embraced by the non-indigenous population, even by the narrowest definition, settler population. It's not necessarily endorsed in an active sense. Sometimes it's downright opposed, but there are ways of maintaining order. There are ways psychologically, intellectually, and otherwise of maintaining order. When that fails, there are sharp-end ways of maintaining order. I'm in Seattle, so I guess you all know about that. We can talk about that. We can talk about how one transforms that situation into the opposite of itself. We can, in effect, talk about anything I know about that you're interested in talking about. And if I don't know about it, you want to talk about it, you can talk about it anyway. Which takes us to another point. I'm tired of being a talking head. I talk too much. I stand up and talk down to people. That's the arrangement. So, is anybody going to be suffering any great sense of loss if I sit down on a level with you? Okay? And those who approach the microphone can talk down to me. Right, you'll have the high ground. Fair? Okay. So, as built, I don't want to stand here at this mic. And I don't want to hold forth other than in an interactive way. I'll probably talk too much anyway. But let's do it in some sort of an exchange fashion. Have a discussion, if necessary, have a debate. Actually, there's about three other points of order I want to get up here. Okay? First thing is, there's got to be somebody out there wondering, what's with the shades? Here's what's with the shades. I like them, so I'm wearing them. If you can't see my eyes, maybe there's a reason. I learned it from the Secret Service. What do you think of that? Okay. Second thing is, how come it's a hot room? He's wearing a jacket. Well, I got this white T-shirt on, which I kept pristine all for the event, right up until 5 minutes before the event when I stopped at something called Seattle's Best Coffee. Which I understand is just another name for Starbucks coffee these days. So you can go to this end of the block and get Starbucks, or you can come back to the other end of the block in Seattle and get Starbucks by another name. I suppose in either event, see, I was trying to keep the shirt clean, so I put a lid on it, which made it, as soon as I took the first step, a little volcano. So I look a bit like Pigpen down the front of the shirt, so I put the jacket on, which amplifies the fact that this is a warm room. Which takes me to the final piece of business, which is, we'll go a while, let's take a break. Two things will happen. Everybody can go out there and bring your body temperature down about 10 degrees, and while you're out there, the temperature of the room can go down about 10 degrees, and we're all going to be happier campers, and probably things will go better if we do. Okay, do we have dissent? Okay, we're off and rolling. Fire when ready.
My question is, exactly how much harassment have you received for the bad publicity you've given the government and the FBI and the NSA? And how is it that you actually travel freely around the country still?
Well, that's a semantic minefield. Okay? How much harassment relative to what? Relative to my mother? A whole hell of a lot. Relative to Leonard Peltier? Not at all. Okay, I've got an FBI file of last time I checked, which was over 10 years ago when you could still use Freedom of Information Act, since I was doing the books on the FBI at the time, I filed FOIA on myself. At that point, I had 2,100-page FBI file. All right, if you consider surveillance monitoring to be harassment, which it's possible to construe it that way, then it's pretty consistent over a fairly long period of time. I don't have more current information directly from the FBI. Couldn't get it if I tried. Have absolutely no reason to believe they suspended operations. Okay. Part of the paper is partial accounts. There's redacted pages, redacted phrases, redacted information in the documents. I've been subject to counterintelligence operations in an active sense 3 times that I know of. And some of you may be familiar with the situation in Denver with the collection of what they called, well, they referred to colloquially as the spy files. The actual police captioning is criminal extremist G. Okay, I don't know what the G stands for. They have never disclosed that. But in any event, There's the compilation on target files for political reasons that was undertaken by the Denver PD. But it's not exclusively by the Denver PD. They collaborate through a JTTF arrangement with the FBI, with other area regional agencies and so forth, and there's federal information in them, so that's an indication that the federal operations continue. Does that answer your question? Okay. There's other stuff I could say, but that's probably enough. The other piece of the question there was traveling freely about the country. Sometimes it's relatively free, sometimes it's less free. In fact, by vehicle, which given the condition of the airports and the general climate on airliners and all the rest of that, I prefer to do any opportunity. I don't fly unless I have to. And it's not because of 911. It's because of the atmosphere that's been created, okay, in the air terminals, on the concourses, in the aircraft themselves. It is not someplace that I'm comfortable being. And I wouldn't be if I was just Joe Blow. That's by design. All right, so I travel by car. I don't know, it's not free to be ticketed twice the price for speeding in a construction zone or whatever. All right. Pop quiz to the group. 1999 is when the entire country decided it was necessary, in fact essential for public safety, health and well-being, whatever, to double fines for speeding in construction zones, which is just about the time they placed every secondary, tertiary, and expressway in the country under construction. Every time the weather was good enough, somebody might be driving. All right? Here's the quiz question. See who can answer it. How many highway construction workers were killed by passenger vehicles in 1999?
Zero.
Well, you're low. There were actually 9. Which would be a little under a half of 1 per state, and no indication at all that any of the 9 were killed by a speeding vehicle. Now, you do with that what you want. But while it's not free to me to make the trip, in my case it's not profitable to the state either, and that's actually, if you think about it, what this is about. It's no public safety issue worthy of the name involved in it. It is an extremely profitable undertaking by the state through which they buy things like riot gear, communications gear, computer technology, fancy, sexy, designer kind of glow strip accouterments for the top of the police cars so they don't actually have to have light racks anymore. You know, those things cost about $1,000 a pop. They have fashion catalogs for cops. Your local police department is equipped with an arsenal that would be the envy of most third world countries. They pay for stuff like that. They pay for the pin register technology and all the rest of that out of this sort of thing. And I'm not really comfortable with, since I'm presenting no public hazard ever when I'm ticketed, can attest to that. We can take that further at some point tonight if you'd like to. If you'd like to challenge it, but I'm presenting no public hazard. I'm simply being asked to ante up to pay for my own repression. Not being comfortable with that, I have a rule of thumb. I smile very politely to the cop, take the ticket, look to see how much the fine's going to be, and before I leave that state, I make sure I cause at least that much property damage and state material before I go. So it's a wash, boys and girls. Now I think I got yours out of the way, okay? Fire away.
Oh, yeah, I'd just like to say that before we like get any further, I'd just like to recognize the fact that we're all on Duwamish tribal territory.
Oh.
Just to make that fact present.
Oh. Oh, well, let me see if I can instigate a riot here now. See, it's usually pretty easy, you just punch buttons. See, I was talking to Paul Watson the other day, and I found out that nobody on Puget Sound retains any land rights, okay? Because it was all put into this malicious plan to slaughter the whales, fishing rights and so forth. So nobody really has land rights because they were so avid to kill sea mammals. So we couldn't possibly be on somebody's land here now, could we? My God. You all that used to Paul Watson? Have you run through that so many times that it's just old hat and boring, or somebody want to actually take the issue up now? I'm dying to get into it a little bit.
I'm Alex Jackson,
oh.
A member, card-carrying member, and my question is, what has been done to try to free our leader, Leonard Peltier? And another thing arises to my mind is to make a big deal out of a woman prisoner being rescued in Iraq. And I admire her myself, but in so doing, they forget about the first woman that fell in combat was a Native American Indian. And we should ask our president to release our leader in her honor. A lot of things have been done for Mexicans and for blacks. Every time a president runs for office, they say, I did this for the Mexicans. I did this for the blacks. What have they done for the American Indians, the real Native Americans? We want our leader out of prison. I was active here in Seattle during the struggles of the 1960s and 70s. I would like to somewhat focus for a moment on Leonard Peltier and his plight. Thank you.
You want the whole? What's been done to try to free Leonard so the people know from day one, or you just want the recent stuff? Recently. Well, let's take recent back 5 years. In 5 years, we'll get us to the point where William Jefferson Clinton, the liberal alternative to the present president, that's Bill, let's put another 100,000 cops on the street, Clinton, you know, the guy that was going to commute the sentence, convey a pardon, actually said he would. But let's examine that for a moment. What the probability of that ever was, because actually Bill Clinton was saying that from before he entered office. Al Gore said it in Minneapolis at the airport. Somebody tried to grab him. Secret Service grabbed their hands so they couldn't touch him, but it got his attention. He looked over and they said, what are you going to do about Leonard? Don't forget Leonard. And he said, we're not forgetting Leonard. So you had that promise for the executive branch at the highest level from before the 8 years began. And Bill Clinton himself was telling people in the Defense Committee that at last moment he needed to hold it off for political reasons because he was going to be burning his political capital, he said. And he signed that commutation. So he was holding it to the very end when he didn't need the political capital anymore because he was going out of office being term limited. Well, what would he have been saying had he signed the commutation? See, to pardon someone is to say they did what it is they were accused of doing. All parties are agreed they did it, and it's okay now. Okay in the sense that there has been a sufficient penalty paid, so you're free to go. The debt is retired. And that is one thing. Put another 100,000 cops on the street. Let's invest in more infrastructure and technology for law enforcement. Clinton is going to be telling the FBI is that it's okay for anybody, Indian or not, to kill two FBI agents for simply having imperiled their life and violated their rights in the most fundamental way. See, the message to be sent is whatever an FBI agent, and read by extension, police officer decides to do to you, you're supposed to suck it up and take it and hope you're going to get justice somehow after the fact if you survive. So the bottom line there is Bill Clinton refused to say one way or another whether the signature was on the piece of paper until 11 p.m. on the night he left office. He left Leonard Peltier sitting there believing he was going to get a commutation. Now, that you can say is detached, that you can say is delusional, that you can say is a thinking of a desperate man who's been in a cage for 27 years and received a promise. He's grabbing at straws. Any human being would be. People on the outside need to be more rational. But that was an act of supreme cruelty, left him until the very last moment. And it wasn't simply Clinton's word that had gotten Leonard's hopes up and gotten other people's hopes up. The prison officials had come around and told him to pack his bag. He had plans made of where he was going. He had a series of paintings he was going to do, and he had an exhibition scheduled. It was at that level with the active encouragement of the Bureau of Prisons. They had his stuff packed, and he was ready to leave. They told him he was out the door. And at 11 p.m., when they called from Kansas to ask one more time, have you signed it? He says, I'm not going to. He had just signed a pardon for Mark Rich, who had fled jurisdiction, charged with a massive crime of pecuniary interest, which there was a good prima facie case. He pardoned him before he even came to trial. In fact, he pardoned him while he was a fugitive from justice. That's a fact. And the deal was this. You had, for the first time in the history of the United States, when the issue of pardon was publicly raised, agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation hold a mass demonstration of sorts, their sort, outside the gates of the White House about a year before Clinton left office. You had nearly 500 FBI agents identifying themselves as such engage in a so-called spontaneous demonstration for which there is no permit. Now, some of you may understand the implications of that. Okay. Funny thing. Washington, D.C. police TAC unit didn't attack the FBI to clear the rabble off the sidewalk because they were engaged in a demonstration without a permit and, in principle, endangering national security by way of constituting clear and apparent danger to the president. And he got the message that there was serious opposition to what he was preparing to do within the ranks of the FBI still. Another interesting caveat, and then I'll cut to the chase on that part. Most of these were young agents. Leonard's been in a cage for 27 years. Actually, we're coming on 28. The Oglala firefight was before that. These guys were in grade school when that happened. They don't know a damn thing about it other than what they're told in bureau culture. Okay? So this is a secondhand animus projection. This is institutionalized animus directed at the individual, irrespective of the facts of the case. They don't know the facts of the case. There's no reason they would. They weren't adults to even take it in through the media when it occurred, and they aren't the case agents. So they have no factual basis, and they're holding demonstrations to keep a human being in a cage over something they ultimately know nothing about. That's the symbology part. It's a symbol of their ability to do this. Okay? People a bit higher in the Bureau then explained to Clinton, you are the subject of three ongoing federal investigations that carry a potential penalty of 24 to 48 years if they're run consecutive, depending on what you are convicted of, whether there's plea bargains and so forth. Were they brought to fruition in an active former president, an actual former president, taken to trial? Now, we can pursue those with a vengeance, and they may never come to trial, but we will make your life absolute hell for an indefinite period of time when you leave office. Because the leash is off then. You're not a sitting president. We can go at you hammer and tong, and we'll have you under investigation and testifying and doing depositions, and we'll be poking into your records, and your neighbors will be getting subpoenaed. We can do that, and you know it, and we will. And that's exactly what we are going to do if you sign that piece of paper commuting the sentence on Leonard Peltier. On the other hand, you cannot sign that piece of paper, and we'll just back off. There's a deal. Now, that's Leonard's take as well. He put that in spirit of Crazy Horse. Since then, there's been a whole lot of turmoil because a lot of people, and I think it was a frail hope to begin with and said so a long time ago. In fact, I'm on a CD over there saying it in 1993. Bill Clinton's never going to do a commutation. But if we strategize this correctly, And this may still be possible because there's merit to what you were saying. Okay? We can make a bid on this guy who's getting rapidly more and more discredited with regard to his relationship to almost every possible conceivable outgroup, so he could make a grand gesture here, but it would have to be approached correctly. Make another bid for pardon. But George W. is not going to commit to a pardon either, for the same reason Clinton wouldn't in the first instance, because the message sent to the FBI, he's not in trouble with the FBI the way Clinton was, but, excuse me, you can build enough public pressure on it so that he understands his political capital has to be expended to fend off the critics if he doesn't do something, and the something he can do is intervene with a parole board and get a parole on the first sentence and expedite the parole in the second and bring the man out of the cage. That is not an ideal solution either, because parole also includes the implication that he did what he was falsely convicted of doing. But let's face it, you got a human being and a symbol, both of which are in the cage. The human being needs to come out of the cage. That's just a human need that should be responded to. In terms of symbology, he stands there falsely convicted, and virtually everyone who's familiar with the case knows he's falsely convicted. Insofar as they can keep him in that cage, it sends that message that it can be rendered cost prohibitive to anyone, again, Indian or no, to stand on what they understand to be their rights. Relinquish your rights and stay safe. Stand on your rights and potentially become another Leonard Peltier. Flip side of that coin is if we can bring him out in any fashion, get him out of the box, we're sending the opposite message. Not that they're doing it through benevolence, but the pressure was brought to bear that forced that result. There's an opposite message. There's better ways than a parole, but we're probably not within a reasonable period that would fit into Leonard's lifetime going to get that accomplished. We're deluding ourselves at this point if we think we will. He ain't getting younger. He needs to come out. Okay.
Good afternoon. Thank you for speaking. My name's Mary T. Andrews. I'm from Thonaatam. Have you ever heard of TOs, Pimas, Papagos? We're all related by language. But we were split up by the federal government, so we're all recognized separately. Actually, a third of us got stuck in Mexico when they did the Gadsden Purchase. I always say when the U.S. purchased California and Nevada, Texas from the drug lords of Mexico at the time. And now you need there's a Berlin Wall there now. But that's not what that's just a FYI for my tribe and you. I wanted to ask you a couple comments. I work for Mothers for Police Accountability. We have a hotline on the crisis line if you ever need us. We're in front of the phone book. And we hand out ACLU, you guys know who that is, American Civil Liberties Union, Know Your Rights and Police Cards. And I was going to ask you today, being in all your driving in America, there's a couple questions here. Have you been racially profiled? And if you have, do you keep track of it? And do you have a Know Your Rights police card? If you don't, there's an updated version since the Patriots Act. So have you seen the old yellow one? Well, they update it to a green one. And the green one got updated since the Patriots Act. And you'll have to contact the ACLU website to find out more. And under languages.
www.aclu.org.
Let's get that.
There you go.
The .org thing. And then U.S. houses more prisoners anywhere in the world. And we the people, you know, it's our governments, our stuff, we have doubled the prison space. And Mothers for Police Accountability, we kid around and we say in the future we got to commit a certain crime to get a certain social service, because there'll be no funding left for us out here and we'll all be arrested or something. And let me see. And then there was also another thing
Don't
can
pile
call.
Them up too deep. I'll forget what they are before I got. I already did that with him. So I'm going to have to start with a piece that I left out on his before I get to yours.
Well, it kind of ties in. We have a high in South Dakota. There's a national Indian newspaper, and there was an article about South Dakota. They're 2%, the 1.9% of the population, yet they're 15% of the prison.
Yeah.
So that's another thing to look at. Natives are getting the highest penalties. Here in King County, Renton, if you look at the different court system, if you follow a Native American court, they get the highest penalties, highest fines, and the highest that. And that's just something we want to bring out, and we'll talk about that later. Thank you.
Yeah, if I miss any piece of that, come back to the mic and we'll get to that too, okay?
Just call me up.
All right. Well, let me hit the last piece just about of the previous set of questions, just a glancing blow before going on. There was no rescue. Jessica Lynch, is that her name? Private Lynch? She was not rescued. It comes out now. Okay. The hot dogs and rescue team went into an empty building. Nobody in there but the so-called captives. The Iraqis had been gone for half a day. That was a media event. It was staged. There's no reality to it. She got hurt. Yeah, true. She got hurt by taking a wrong turn. Okay, the entire column took a wrong turn. Finally, without having overwhelming firepower, ended up in combat with somebody, and they got shot to pieces. They got taken prisoner. There's no indication that anything beyond the initial wounding was done, and the people who were guarding them took off. Then Special Forces personnel went in, carried them out on stretchers, and they turned it into a major news event as if it was Chuck Norris going into Beirut in that, what is that, Delta Force movie? Yeah. The reality versus the cinematic or media presence of things usually rather different, and that's simply one case. But since you mentioned it, I thought I would bring that out. Am I racially profiled? That's an interesting one. Look at me. Okay? I can slide in and out just about at will. And unless they know who I am and are specifically looking for me, they're probably not going to notice. I tend to be taller than your average crowd height, so I stand out that way. Okay? But I got genetic camouflage. So overall, I tend not to be much racially profiled. Well, yes, I am. And this doesn't get talked about much. See, when we talk about racial profiling, it carries this negative connotation. Well, this is negative, but it's negative in a really backhand way. See, all white people tend to get racially profiled, too. They don't get stopped. All right, they don't get thrown up against the wall and searched. They don't get taken down arbitrarily. That's called white skin privilege. Now, that's not a universal. There's always exceptions to the rule, but understand what exceptions are. They're proof to the rule. So, yeah, I'm racially profiled in a way that's very useful to me. On the kind of negativity in profiling you're talking about, I'm politically profiled. So I never know whether I'm getting on the airplane. The only reason y'all could be sure I was going to be here tonight was because I wasn't flying. When I have to fly because of time compression or whatever, it's a roll of the dice. And I've been kept off airplanes, and I've been kept off out of Canada and stuff, and that's on the political profiling. We could go into that, but I think you know what I mean. They got a list. Interesting thing about that, too, because this room is full of who this room is full of, which means this could apply probably pretty much to any of you at any given moment. The airline will sell you a ticket, and then the airline will tag you. All right? And you may or may not get your money back. I was just down in Eugene, at the Break Change Conference, Doc Juia was there, and they had just done it to him within the last month. They sold him a one-way ticket, United Airlines, and then United Airlines alerted airport security that they weren't comfortable with him flying. Having sold him the ticket one way, it was because it was a one-way ticket, because he's obviously Indian. Okay? And obviously Indian in a way that makes them kind of nervous. So they denied him passage on the flight. And he's trying to get his money back. This is a month later. He's trying to get his money back. So, you can make your own assessment of whether Doc was probably kept off the airplane for racial reasons or political reasons, or whether there's not a confluence of the two in the minds of the authorities. And that's what really the kind of racial profiling we ought to be considering is about, considering in this context, because if you are Arab, for example, you are automatically profiled as a potential terrorist. Period. And you can be asked to leave a plane because some Nordic-looking woman two rows down tells the stewardess she's not comfortable with you being there. Your presence makes her uncomfortable. Why? Because it was Arabs who flew planes into the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. See? And that fact, she's on an airplane and there's an Arab, and somehow psychologically it makes her uncomfortable, so it's very understandable that she not be asked to leave, since she's made it clear that she's not going to be a very good risk for the flight, but rather the individuals sitting there doing nothing have to leave. And why, by the way, did it take Arabs to do what people here should have done a long time ago? Fire away. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, come back around. After he's done, you had two more questions attached to that. See, I did it again. When I get multiples, I usually hit one hard and the other two slide.
Recently, an old Indian who works over in Pike Place Market a couple blocks from here was detained by police and offered some sort of shove to one of the officers in resistance. He was evidently drunk, according to what they say, and so they broke three of his ribs, and he just got out of surgery for having his spleen removed. This has happened to a number of older Indians and younger Indians, and actually a lot of people who...
I was just hearing about a younger Indian while standing out in the sidewalk, same story.
Who were on the streets. I mean, the thing...
Oh, it's the same one? Okay.
My question is, do you think that the training of these officers can be modified to not include just arbitrarily beating the hell out of people and acting as a judge, jury, and executioner?
Well, now.
Oh, by the way, his name was Raymond Nix, and we can't find him or talk to him.
The victim or the cop? Okay. Where to pick up with this one? Where you ended up was, can these cops be trained? It's not an issue of training. The answer is no. Okay? In the conventional sense, the training is meant. You're not going to send them down for a bunch of sensitivity workshops and this and that and the other thing and have a different result. If by training you mean give them about 25 years in the maximum security prison when they do something like this, yeah, you can probably get some results out of that. But what you got to understand, you can intervene in this and you can get a successful outcome. They're exactly right. Get people down there and show people are paying attention, and they'll cut their losses quite often. And this individual can come out with no more damage than nearly losing his life. A lot of people do lose their lives in these situations. However, there's a whole volume of just small, like a high school yearbook pictures of people killed by the police over the last 10 years, I believe it was. It leaves off in 2001. It's called Stolen Lives. Take a look at it. That's the ones who were not so lucky. You've got it. Good. It's exactly what I'm talking about. All right. The thing that's usually put out. You want to say something before I go? Go ahead. You can. Okay. Thing that's usually put out. There's a couple. Rogue cops. All right, that's the first. When you catch them out on this, it's bad cops. And it's going to get reported, and it's going to get reported in a contextual jacket that goes like this. These are bad cops, but not all the cops are bad. We're not implying that all the cops... Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Not all cops are busting people's spleens. That's a fact. But all the cops on the force know the cops that are. And they know that this is not an excess... It's not an abuse of authority, it's a crime. And they're covering for the crime, and that in itself is a crime. Every cop on the force, until this is corrected, is a criminal. And they need to be viewed as such, and that needs to be made clear. But the way they finesse the idea that the crime is actually the crime is because of the nature of the job and the dangers of the job. It's a stressful job and it's a hazardous job, and you hear it inside out. There's not a person in this room that has not heard that to the point where you ought to want to vomit. Let me give you a little news flash on the hazards of being a police officer in any city in America. It is more dangerous to be a garbage collector. That's a fact. You will sustain more serious injuries and have a higher probability of dying on a job if you collect garbage. It's more dangerous to one a wood chipper and a weed whipper. Okay? Cops are way down the line in terms of hazards. There is absolutely no excuse for this. In order to make a routine traffic stop, they got to have three squad cars pull up with riot gear. We've arrived at a situation probably in Seattle is similar to what it is in Denver, where a cop cannot go in and have that famous donut without backup. Got to have backup for everything. Okay? They are not running any particular hazard by virtue of being cops, and so the excesses, so-called, that they engage in cannot accrue from job stress and fear. And the nature of the job, which they've lost sight of, is to protect the citizenry, which includes the people they're beating up. And if they're running a risk, that's their job. And if they don't want the job, then they should go hire onto the garbage truck. Be safe. Or run a risk. Okay, we got that part. The final thing you need to bear in mind, after all is said and done, those cops are doing their job. That is their job. It's the unstated aspect. When they talk about law and order, law serves order. The function of the police is to understand, apprehend the reality that in this society, in this structure, and actually in any other, this has a particular pecking order here, there is a place for everything and a place for everyone, and their job is to keep everyone and everything securely in their place. And you know what the place of American Indians are in this society. They're sending a message. And that is a law enforcement function. It's not the written statutory codified law. It's the more important law, the law of order in this society. And that's their preeminent function. Until you change the nature of the social structure they serve, you're going to get the same result, and that's exactly what you expect. So, no, there is not some little cosmetic intervention or reformist intervention or tweaking and tuning that we can do to turn the police into the opposite of themselves. Let's get real. The police are doing exactly what the police are supposed to be doing. If you want them to do something else, you've got to change the entire nature of the order ultimately. Okay. Oh, yeah, they missed one in Denver. Was a justifiable homicide where a guy supposedly backed his car to an officer who was trying to stand it, to stop him. Okay, put it in reverse and was backing up, and the officer felt imperiled, so the officer emptied his service revolver, which was a .44 Magnum, fired all five rounds, reloaded, and fired five more. And they found that to be justifiable because of the threat that was posed by the individual. Now, that wasn't the only cop on the scene. There were others firing at the same time. This is the one that was behind the car. He fired 10 rounds out of a five-shot weapon. And this was found to be justifiable. That's not in that book, although it's within the time frame. So there's a bunch more. Oh, yeah. They fired close to the Diallo case. It was just under 40 shots. Diallo was 41.
I'm just wondering if he was there putting in bullets or if he just slapped them back in.
No, he just pulled a quick load. Okay. He dumped rounds while he's pulling the others out, slams them in, and keeps firing. But they fired for a while. The guy was riddled. He was dead, and they kept shooting him. Yeah, that was justifiable. But I want to ask a question because you talked with the individual. Did he say he was really drunk? Okay. Did he say he assaulted a cop?
They told him he assaulted a cop.
Okay.
Which means they assaulted him, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm asking if he said he did, because I'm missing the teeth on this side of my head from resisting arrest and assaulting a cop, which occurred in Chicago, and I never even saw the club coming until it was about that far from my eye. He came at me from behind. Caught me full force, took out the teeth inside of my head, and I was arrested for assaulting him. Now, again, I don't look especially Indian, so I wasn't charged with being drunk, too. They found that out after the charges were filed, okay? But I've been charged with resisting arrest on multiple occasions, and there was no resistance to the arrest at all. I've been charged with a cop on four occasions, and only one of them did I actually assault the cop, and that was with him on my back. I ran his head into a concrete post. Okay, but he had to be on my back for that to happen, so it wasn't me attacking him. I was defending myself from his attack. Interestingly enough, on occasions that I have resisted arrest, I haven't been charged, so go figure.
I'm just here to ask you people to bring a friend when you show up tomorrow at 2 o'clock. The plight of an Indian prisoner in these jails here in Seattle is never told. I was in jail after a severe beating. If not for Mary Andrews, I would have been forgotten there. And what I'm telling you now is the truth. Native American Indians do not get medical care in these jails in Seattle. Because you're Native American, you have no feelings, you have no pain, you don't even get diseases, you don't get crippled. And that's how they treat you in jail. I was so severely beaten that they took a disc out of my back. And I'm partially paralyzed for that. And if not for the blacks in there, they would call us from a tank and say, pick up your tray. The tray would be on the floor. The first day I fell on my face, two black guys picked me up and said, we'll get the tray for you. Don't try to bend down and get the tray again. The police heard that and took the black guys, moved them to another tank. And the chief of the police at that time came to me and said, you're Native American. You're not hurt. You're not ill. I had a ruptured disc at the time he was talking to me like this. And I said, why is it there's nothing but blacks and whites in the hospital ward of this jail? I can see it. You put me right where I could see it to show me you're not giving me medical care like the rest of the prisoners. It was then at that time that I got released and got medical care. So it is important that you do bring a friend. I'll tell you where you're going to be sitting. There's a bulletproof glass around the court. It's from here to that pillar. The spectators are behind there sitting on benches. There's very small place. If we can flood that place with too much people, those politicians have to look at us and say, look at it, they got the masses. We will be a threat to them if we show up in the masses. They understand massive votes more than anything. Thank you.
I guess in the narrow framing of this particular case, because that's what's immediately on the table, here's a thought. There is a rule, it'd be part of the police guidelines, but it also is a statutory force, and the attorney here can tell you this is true. It's a rule of proportionality. So you might be raising the issue of how an old, or at least elderly by description, and very drunk man, irrespective of his race, could present such a threat to an armed, young, trained police officer that it was necessary to use such force as to rupture his spleen. Okay, again, this is on its face, criminal behavior. And it needs to be pressed as such. And the harder you press that, the more eager they're going to be to cut this case loose. And they'll trade it off, ultimately, not to charge the cop. They won't charge anybody. And if your narrow objective is, as it should be, to get the individual out of this situation, you deal with the broader issues as well, but the immediate issue is to get him out. Press it that way. And show up. Show up. Show up in force and keep showing up. Talk about it on the radio. Talk about it on the street. do the thing that Yuppie area of Seattle hates the most, plaster it with flyers. Use epoxy instead of rice glue. There's all sorts of things you can do to make sure you got their attention. AA works for some people. We don't put it down. AA does not work for all people. We shouldn't pretend that it does. And a lot of people don't drink because they're looking for a recreational activity. A lot of people drink because they're traumatized and they're trying to nullify a reality that's intolerable. And praying doesn't always fix it for people. We need to do some more tangible fixing so they got some options other than trying to nullify reality. It's called create a reality that's acceptable. And you don't do that in immediate little circles. And I'm not dissing AA because I've seen it work for people, but it has its limits, and we need to get beyond those limits. Well, I'm not going to debate you on it. You raised it, so I addressed it. And if you drink alcohol and you can handle it, fine. If you can't, don't. If AA works, use it. If AA doesn't work, we need some other options out there. The issue is the officer's behavior in this, not the victim's behavior. The victim's behavior in this sense simply compounds the severity of the officer's offense, because when you're seriously drunk, you cannot present a threat. There goes the excuse for having leveled this kind of damage on a human being. Well, they'll make an excuse that they were presented with such a threat that it was necessary to use force, and this was due force application, and that resulted in these injuries. You can't make the case on an old guy who's stumbling drunk. Simple. And let's just leave it right there. Okay?
You mentioned a little bit ago, why did it take a bunch of Arabs to do what you all should have done a long time ago? That's my question. As a white man standing here in your midst from a very fairly liberal, conservative, middle-of-the-road background, and I tell people I'm so far left, I'm coming up on the right. And I'd like you to respond to it. Why shouldn't we do something, and how could we move so that they don't see us coming?
I'm going to repeat that and tell me if I got it right. Why shouldn't you do something? And how do you move so they don't see you coming? Okay. As to the first part, not a reason in the world that I can see. I can't find a single reason that you shouldn't, in principle way. There may be some practical considerations, such as, do you know how? You know. Often these things are processes. It's not just an impulse. And certainly it's not just an event. And the simple answer, although it probably should be more complicated, but I'm not being flippant, given the simple answer, is you carry the weapon. That's how they don't see it coming. You're the one that you're just going to be. They talk about colorblind, they're blind to your color. You said it yourself. Okay? You don't send the Black Liberation Army into Wall Street to conduct an action. You don't send the American Indian Movement into downtown Seattle to conduct an action. Who do you send? You, with your beard shaved, your hair cut close, and wearing a banker's suit. There's probably a whole lot more to it. You know that. But there's where you start. Who carries the front end? Why is it always people of color carrying the weight on this, with people who are much more proximate in terms of acceptability to the centers of power, professing solidarity and principled nonviolence on the one hand, and critiquing the practice of those who are carrying the weight on the other? Why is that? Now, again, there's exceptions to that rule. I could name some. I could name one from right up in here, Ed Mead. Okay, there's a bunch more. Exceptions, however, prove rules, and you know as well as I do that the rule I'm articulating is correct. That's the way it works. You want to do what you're talking about? Turn that completely around. Room got really silent now.
All right, now that I got you in Seattle, I got to ask you this face to face. What is your opinion on what I term neo-Aboriginals. And what I mean...
Neo-Aboriginals.
Yeah, and what I mean by that is, whenever I discuss treaties, native sterilization, indigenous genocide, all of a sudden the person that I'm talking to is somehow, by some construction, native. Mm-hmm. And I'd just like to hear how that usually works out and how you usually confront it when it does appear.
Could you repeat the question for the camera?
The question was, how do I feel about neo-natives? That being, when you bring up issues having to do with the indigenous-settler relationship, I'll frame it that way, somehow or another, the settler representative could become some part native. My first response is, native what? That's a legitimate question. Everybody's native something. Everyone has an indigenous tradition somewhere. Okay, just in a lot of these cases, it doesn't happen to be here. You want to identify with indigenous traditions? I say right on, do it. Do it with your own. Reconnect with your own tradition. Resuscitate and revitalize it. See, the biggest mind trip of all has been run on those who identify themselves as, well, they always pronounce our name, so I'll return the compliments. Europeans. See, Europe doesn't exist. Think I'm kidding? I'm not. Show me its eastern boundary. Show it. Where is it? The Ural Mountains? That's a convenient geographic feature that they seized on to have something that would appear to be an eastern boundary. Okay, they make that demarcation and therefore designate a couple of appendages off the Asian landmass, not only as a continent in its own right, but the continent. Oh yeah, we all know what's referred to when we refer to the continent, it's Europe. If that definition works, how about India? Urals are a significant geographic feature. You could say that demarcates what's called Europe from Asia. Then certainly the Himalayas would constitute an even more significant geographical feature, and you got more population and more culture to the south of the Himalayas than you do to the west of the Urals. You don't have any sort of cultural cohesion at all until you got Charlemagne conquering the indigenous peoples of Europe, one after another, moving outward from Aachen, Germany, in concentric circles over a several hundred year period of time to basically synthesize something called Europe. It was invented through that process for reasons of efficiency. But what's the tagline on that? In order to become what Europeans have convinced themselves and been convinced that they are, which is the colonizer, and that happens to be true, to become the colonizer, you had first to be colonized. But the colonization is so deep historically in the tradition of Europeans and so repressed intellectually and psychologically, you've forgotten the fact of your colonization, and you can't be more colonized than that, meaning that those who are the colonizer are the most colonized of all. Okay, hook back into your own indigenous traditions and take your own decolonization seriously, and maybe we can form alliances, but don't come and tell me that you're reincarnation of some 17th century Cheyenne warrior and therefore entitled to run my sweat lodge next week. Yeah. Was that neo enough?
Thanks for coming. Back in the early days of the slave trade and the colonists doing the East Coast, moving here, the most common thing for the indentured servants was to run away and join the Indians. So, and that was against the law. Backing up a step to the Twin Towers falling down. There's been implications about how... Well, the first thing I thought about when it went down was, oh, shit, that plays right into what they want to do to us. I'd like... Maybe you can follow up on that.
Your first thought was, well, yeah, you put it pretty well. I'll accept you at your word. Your first thought was, oh, shit, that plays right into what they want to do to us. I know. I know. Well, then, welcome to the club. Welcome to the club along with 565,000 Iraqi children who were systematically starved and denied medical attention to death in less than 10 years. While Madeleine Albright goes on television on 60 Minutes, no less, receives the number, says, yes, I've heard it, and we've decided it's worth the cost. Welcome to the club with the rest of the world a little bit. I don't care if it plays into the hands of what they had in mind for you, unless you're doing something tangible to make it stop what's already being done to those people on the receiving end. Why should you be exempt and immune? Yeah. So, instead of, oh shit, right on. Right on. And I'm trying to elicit some response. I want someone to take this up, because I know you all aren't agreeing with me on this. They're referred to as Wappingers. That was not their own name. I do not know their own name for themselves, but I do know what is recorded in the history books. You want to know what happened to the Wappingers? The Dutch traded them some beads. You've all heard that story. Not for Manhattan Island, but to be able to use a portion of Manhattan Island. They rented it. Those Indians, like most people, did not have crystal balls. They couldn't see what was going to be done to Manhattan Island, or they would have been paying the Dutch to take it. All right, that's one of the few chunks of geography in North America that no native person in their right mind would have back under any circumstances. Do not try to give us Manhattan Island back. Okay, you're stuck with it. But the Dutch who had rented the land, got themselves established on it, and decided that that myth that's going to be told forever after was how it was going to be. And not only with the land that they had rented through these trade goods, but the entirety of the island. So they mounted a campaign, and they eradicated, by and large, everyone who understood themselves to be a Wappinger. And then they cut the heads off the men, and they took them back to approximately the location of the World Trade Center, and they played kickball in the streets of what they called New Amsterdam, while the non-male, that is, women and children population, assembled themselves as spectators and cheered. The karma of that spot goes way back. You know, I wrote a piece right after that happened, talked about with attribution to Malcolm X. Here are the chickens coming home to roost. No, not chickens so much, if you want to have an image of it, as it is ghosts. And it started with those 565,000 Iraqi children being ghosts that were riding the wings of those 300,000-pound cruise missiles as they went in and took out the technocratic centers of financial empire. They couldn't have picked better targets, both symbolically and literally. Following behind those 565,000 were those 3.2 million Indochinese. And following behind that were those 250,000 people incinerated at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we're right on the anniversary of that. You know, this is the week. But not just those incinerated in those two cities, the even larger number that was incinerated by Curtis LeMay's B-29 bombers. Quite deliberately, they practiced for months beforehand. They did mock-ups in the Nevada desert simulating Japanese cities so they'd know what the burn patterns were so that they could eradicate 200,000 Japanese civilians by fire, roast them alive. Those ghosts were on those wings too. And we can keep checking them back. 500,000 to a million Moros in the Indian War fought in the Philippines. And those ghosts were joined by Bigfoot's people at Wounded Knee. And those were joined by those slaughtered at Slim Buttes. And those were joined by the dead from the Ouachita River. And those were joined from the dead by the dead from Sand Creek and from the Bosque Redondo, all the way back to Sullivan's campaign that was ordered by George Washington against the Seneca, where they went out and leveled the agricultural land and salted the wells and cut down the orchards and came back wearing as a symbol of martial honor the tan skins of those they had slaughtered. And those ghosts were joined by those who were butchered off for bounty and scalps. All the way back, we take it, to those Wappinger heads being kicked around for sport in the streets where they erected the World Trade Center, just below Wall Street, which takes its name from the wall that enclosed the slave quarters, okay, because that was a sailing point for human flesh in the African slave trade. Now, there is a colossal amount of karma, if you want to call it that. There's other things it can be called, but that word resonates. And there has to be something that's going to balance it. The people who were in there, who were the technocrats, were more conversant than Joe Palooka out there bowling in Pittsburgh with what it was that was being done in Iraq. And that had been announced. They were not unaware. But what they were was preoccupied with finding the perfect cappuccino and buying a new cell phone, BMW, and loft apartment on the proceeds of starving children's flesh. These were the technocrats in the same sense that Eichmann was a technocrat. And before someone jumps up and says, Eichmann was a Nazi and these people weren't killing people like him, he arranged train schedules. He made the Holocaust possible. He did not personally perpetrate it. He didn't kill anybody in a direct sense, just the same as they didn't kill anybody in a direct sense. They were the people who made the machinery of the killing work. Why didn't we do that? I didn't say y'all. Why didn't we take the initiative to do what needed to be done to send the message that you cannot do what I was just talking about with impunity? Because it is a sense of impunity, the entitlement to exemption from the costs and consequences of carnage, that causes the carnage to continue. Do we really need the equivalent of the 8th Air Force to do what has to be done to this country in order to make what it is this country is doing stop? Or can we stop being good Germans long enough to take the responsibility, the charge, the mantle that was put down at Nuremberg when the Germans were found to be collectively guilty, not of perpetrating the specific crimes necessarily committed by the Third Reich, but of default of their basic citizenly and human responsibilities to do whatever was necessary to get that government on a leash so that it could not do what it was that it did. What ultimately, because of their default, it took the rest of the world in an extravagantly violent military process to stop. There were children, I'm told, in the World Trade Center. I have no reason to disbelieve that. I'm sure there were. And I mourn the children. The children could not have been guilty. I mourn each child in the World Trade Center exactly as much as I mourn every Iraqi child. All right? There weren't 500 children in the World Trade Center. Although to hear the left from New York in response to my article, there were exactly 6,974 underpaid janitors in that building among the 3,000 dead. Okay, and every leftist in New York City had at least 10 of them as personal relatives, friends, and acquaintances, okay? So they all knew this to be a fact. Everyone in there, in other words, was innocent. And if you are acquiescent in the face of genocide, I don't care who you are not innocent. There's gradations of guilt and culpability, no doubt, but innocence does not apply. And we had a period of time there when we had a whole new word introduced to the language, and I was hearing it from the opposition as much as I was hearing it from George Bush. And the new word was innocent American. That's all one word. You couldn't say one without the other, innocent American. I've never met an innocent American above 7 years of age. Well, maybe we can take it up to 12. But by 12, they're actively engaged in the consumption that results in the carnage out there. It's not necessarily their fault. But ultimately, a responsibility has to be assigned. You know, it wasn't necessarily Charlie Manson's fault either. You look at what happened to Charlie Manson, you make a pretty good case that there was probably no other way he was going to act, and the state had done it, which is what he said in court. I'm state-produced. State made me. I don't mind going back to prison. I'm real comfortable in prison. It's the only place I ever been. It's being on the outside here that I can't really relate to. I end up doing stuff like I just did. Yeah. You can't really blame Charlie in a certain sense, but you gotta nonetheless hold Charlie accountable. We gotta hold ourselves accountable and get over this notion that somehow or another we're entitled. And probably nobody in the room, and at some level, even me, who's saying this, still has a sense that, yeah, there's a lot of guilt, but I'm different. I'm different when I win. Because I've had that said, well, you could be on one of those airplanes, you fly a lot. I fly less. But it's true, I do fly a lot, and I could be on one of those airplanes. And you're in struggling in opposition and blah, 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 blah. That's true, too. And I haven't won. And until I win, I can be held accountable to the same standard, ineffectuality. Ineffectuality in this context is not excusable. Not to the people whose children are being butchered. So let me lay that out as an incitement to devise strategies that can actually have an effect beyond the symbolic value of bearing moral witness. We've been bearing moral witness to this kind of thing in this country for well over a century. It's about time we stopped bearing moral witness all the time and started coming to grips with what it is that ultimately has to be done to tangibly change the relations of power and consequently the relations between people and between people in the environment. Yeah. Okay, you're ready to rock and roll.
Thanks. Not discounting anything that you said and, you know, taking it for granted, and I don't think most people in the room would disagree, that our society is probably the closest thing to a cancer that this planet has seen in known human history. I think listening to Brian's question, and I think I tended to agree with it. My first reaction when I heard about those towers hit, and that hit me that day, and I wrote something about it that appears on the IMC sites that day, both in New York and here, was the Reichstag is burning. The Reichstag, for those people who are a little bit soft on their history, was a main building of German government. And what happened in the 1930s is it mysteriously caught fire and served as a pretext for the Nazis to come to power. The best conclusion and the best evidence now is that the Nazis were probably the ones who did it. And of course, if people are a little bit soft on their history, the Nazi intelligence, the SS, was not destroyed. It became the founding fathers of our CIA because guess who had the best intelligence on the Russians when World War I was over? Are we going to throw them in jail or are we going to use them? You know the way our government works. We do it with our rocket scientists. We do it with their intelligence agents. Well, every war that this government of the United States, and I don't like calling it America because America's two continents and there are a lot of other countries under America, but every war that the government of the United States has been involved in has involved massive deceit, massive lies. We can look at things like the totally fabricated Gulf of Tonkin incident, which created the Vietnam War. We can look at what was going on around Pearl Harbor. For those who haven't looked at James Banford's latest book that came out about a year or so ago, there was even plans following the Bay of Pigs to begin blowing up things around U.S. cities, sinking U.S. ships. If one of our rockets had exploded, blaming all of that on the Cubans. so that we would have the pretext to invade Cuba. And that was something that got as far as the Joint Chiefs of Staff when you had one person, Robert McNamara, according to best documentation, who blocked it. We don't have anyone in the current administration who I would see playing that role. So I guess my statement and my question would be sort of when you're looking at this thing, I'm still not sure who did it. And I still ask the first question any detective would ask, which is, who benefits? And it's the guy with the monkey face and the Alfred E. Newman smile who stole the election that I see doing it. You know, the third generation successor to Bonzo's co-star. There seems to be this sort of like degeneration in the Republican presidents we notice, you know, putting in these really stupid people as vice president. We had Eisenhower, who was a moron. We had Reagan, who was senile and then was co-star to a chimp. And then George Senior was lonely, so he picked someone who resembled his son, Dan Quayle. And then we get the real article as our president this time around. But I'd add that caveat. And if you've got any comments on it.
Sure. Well, first of all, if you really believe that that was the equivalent of the Reichstag fire, and that whoever set this up was the equivalent of Hermann Göring, who's the guy who carried that one out, then you're even more remiss, okay, because your interpretation is these are literal Nazis, and they present an imminent peril to you, and it's even a clearer analogy to what I said about the German. Their default was they did not do what needed to be done for themselves as well as for everybody else. So we're not inconsistent. I don't choose to take an interpretation absent absolute concrete proof of some sort that would disempower brown people from being able to make a response of this kind. I'm not going to credit evil white genius with it until someone proves me that it was a white guy in charge of that too. No matter what gets done, positive or negative, if it's consequential, some white guy had to be behind it. That's the problem with the interpretation. But if you can believe it's a Reichstag fire, it's a feasible scenario in my mind. Why haven't you proceeded to do what everybody concurred the Germans needed to have done while there was a possibility of doing it before? So there's that piece. Second is, I'm not soft in my history. The Galen organization was Abwehr, not SS. The SS mostly went into special forces so far as the U.S. used them, okay? I served with them in Vietnam. They were there. That's Waffen-SS is very different from the Galen organization. That's the intelligence organization at issue. Okay. Yeah, they create a pretext if they can get a consensus that it's impermissible to take any kind of action and therefore no one will in this country, that we can be in solidarity with the guerrillas of El Salvador. There's some people old enough here to remember CSPACE. Absolute principle nonviolent posture within the United States, we are in utter solidarity with. Armed struggle somewhere else. We were in struggle with the NFLF. We were in struggle and solidarity with the, did I say NLF? Okay. FALN is what I meant. FLN, okay. NLF, alphabet soup. What we just did was two countries in Central America and now into Southeast Asia. The mentality is that solidarity with people in armed struggle is a recognition of the fact that it's necessary to engage in armed struggle in the context that are created by this country somewhere else, anywhere else but here. The only thing is nonviolence, because nonviolence is safe, and in a context where there is a repudiation by the opposition of anything that would be material damage to the system right along with the system itself, then you have a condition in which these can be used as pretext. If you had an actual consequential response that says when you do this sort of thing in Grenada, say, or Panama, it's going to cost you a whole lot at home, not just in withdrawal of political consent, which is mostly symbolic anyway, but materially as well, they wouldn't be so quick and inclined to do that. That's the point. So you can interpret it this way or I can interpret it that way, but it comes out to the same point in my mind, and we still have all those ghosts unresolved riding on the wings of those aircraft, irrespective of where, whether the CIA sent them or something that was essentially, if you want to think about it, created in large part by the CIA, which would be Al-Qaeda. Did Osama bin Laden work for the CIA? No, there's no indication that Osama himself or any of his major leadership figures, the people who are running that organization, had any particular connection with the CIA ever. But the people who manufacture the explosive devices and run the munitions systems and so forth were all CIA trained. So I guess in a way you could say it was CIA either way, couldn't you? Whether it's a Reichstag fire or it's a response. But tagline is this. You're going to take an initiative sufficient to bring a instability to the system of a magnitude that allows for a leashing of its lethal impulses, or those on the receiving end are going to respond. If you don't like the way it was done on September 11th, and a lot of Americans don't, and I can understand why, then Americans are going to have to do for themselves what by default they're going to compel other people to do. That can probably be a far gentler process than if the other side has to do it. Okay? It would have been a whole lot easier in the Germans if they'd done it themselves, no matter how bloody it ended up being in the short term, than to get saturation bombed, invaded, and occupied for 25 years. Unlikely to happen here, perhaps in the short term, but hey, the bill comes due eventually. You either shoulder the responsibility of doing what has to be done in the face of power that maintains itself the way this one does, dictating the terms of struggle, or somebody somewhere eventually is going to do it for you. And you probably aren't going to like that experience. Now, Native North America as a whole can tell you something about being occupied by a foreign power that doesn't care a whole lot about your sense and sensibility. All right, you don't have to take my word for it. Ask an Indian, any Indian, what it's like to live in occupied America. Occupied America will be occupied America irrespective of who the occupier is if decolonization does not occur. Decolonization in terms of Native North America, but I already indicated decolonization is a process that needs to be gone into for those who fancy themselves to be on the colonial side of the equation and stepping out of that tradition. You need to step out of it in a different way.